Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly program of analysis and commentary on the economic aspects of our lives, our jobs, our incomes, our debts, our future prospects, the debts of our children, all of the economic realities we face and that we have to cope with. I'm your regular host, Richard Wolff. I've been an economics professor all of my adult life at several universities. Currently, I teach in the New School University in New York City. I also write commentary on a regular basis for truthout.org, a remarkable independent source of news and commentary every day. Check them out at truthout.org. If the commentaries, the analyses, the documents, the points we bring up in this program are interesting, then I want to make you aware that we maintain two websites updated and added to every day, where you can find more of exactly what this program is all about. The first one is rdwolf.com, and the second one is democracyatwork.info. Either of those two websites can be used by you as you like, 24/7, no charge whatsoever. And both websites offer you two other opportunities we hope you will take advantage of. The first is to send us your comments, criticisms, suggestions, questions. At the end of each program, we pick one or more of your questions and respond to them. We also read every email you send in order to help us design and plan each program that we bring to you. And the other thing you can do on either website is to sign up for our free regular newsletter. Comes to you every couple of months, telling you what we're doing, interesting sidelights to the activities we do. Again, free of all charge, delivered to you through email in the usual way. And finally, both websites offer you a chance, which we hope you will take advantage of, to click on an icon and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. So let me turn then to the economic updates for this week. I want to begin by responding to something many of you have written to me about. Some of you have said, is the United States a land of opportunity anymore? Is it a land where people who are poor can become rich and all the rest of it? Do we have a society that might in some sense be called a level playing field, where everybody has a chance, more or less the same, to make it? And I'm afraid that the results that I have to present to you answer that question in a pretty straightforward no. And since I'm not given to sugarcoating these things, and I assume you want an honest answer, I'm going to try to provide it. Before I do, let me tell you where I'm going to draw the information I'm about to give you. The Demos Foundation, D-E-M-O-S, which you can find at demos.org, is an interesting source of statistics about all of these things. And in particular, they have a section on their website called Policy Shop. And under that, they have produced a document called America's Class System Across the Life Cycle. In other words, they want to ask, how do parents and children look? Do children start at the same place regardless of whether their parents are rich or poor? Or does it really matter what chances a child has in the United States? Does it really count that their parents are rich or in the middle or at the bottom? In other words, is there mobility? Do the children of the poor make it? Do the children of the rich sink down into this, and so on? And I'm just going to pick some of the rich statistical work that the Demos.org folks have provided. So the first thing I'm going to look at is, and report to you about, is the statistic about if you compare where a family exists, where the parents in a family exist on the distribution of income, to how their children did 20, 30 years later, do we see change? And the answer is No, we don't. What do I mean? They did the work. They looked at where the parents across the spectrum in America, from poor to middle to rich, they looked at where the parents were, and then they examined where did their children end up. In other words, did the children of rich people end up in the middle of poor? Did the children of poor people end up in the middle of the rich? How did it go? And what they did is they took a group of folks, parents, in the 1970s, and then looked at how their children did a generation later. And the line is such that I can say to you without any hesitance, those who were at the bottom, their children ended up there. Those who were in the middle, their children ended up there. And those who were rich, their children ended up there. Sure, there were a few exceptions, but statistics tells us about the average, about what happened to most people. And the answer is the United States is a place where for most people, the absolute accident of where you were born, you did not determine who your parents were, or let alone what their income was. But your parents determined your likely economic future. Their status in the distribution of income is overwhelmingly likely to be yours. Mobility, for individuals occasionally, yeah. But as a bet, as a description of our society, not even close. The next thing from Demos I want to tell you about is a kind of explanation for what I just said. Here is a statistic they developed where they asked the following question. How much money was left by parents when they died to their children? Now, this is a very important statistic because what they did was they said, let's see, for those who had less than X dollars when they died, they obviously could only leave that amount. The richer you got, well, how much did you leave to your kids? In other words, how much of an advantage did your kids get by inheriting your wealth? And here the statistics are stunning. Those who had less than $25,000 left nothing to their relatives. In other words, there was nothing left. Those who had $25,000 to $50,000 left a trivial amount. In fact, nothing significant beyond a few thousand dollars was left by people who even had as much as a quarter of $1 million at the end of their lives. With the expenses and all the other things, they didn't have much to leave. But now we go, it's really interesting, to those who had between $500 and $1 million at the end of their lives. How much were they able to pass? You know, in terms of after you pay your taxes and after you have all your expenses of taking care of your obligations. Interesting number, about $300,000. So families with $500 to $1 million left $300,000 to their descendants. Significant? Yes. Enormous? No. For what about families who had over $1 million at the end, after they paid their taxes and saved? How much did they leave? $700,000. Oh, this is getting better. If you had $1 million, you could leave $700,000. Compare that to the vast majority of people who didn't have a quarter of $1 million, let alone more than that. They left next to nothing. So for most people, they leave their children very, very little. Nothing or a few thousand dollars. You have to have at least $500,000 socked away at the time you die to leave your descendants anything, and then you don't leave them very much, $100,000. You have to have $1 million, which means most Americans are not even in the story. But now we get to the top 1%, the top 1% of estates, the top 1% of people in America who have the most money when they die. How much do they, on average, the top 1%, leave to their descendants? I think you're going to find this interesting. Answer, $2.7 million. That's on average. So if you are born into the 1%, you inherit, or you and your siblings, $2.7 million, compared to which nearly everybody else has a trivial amount of money if they get anything at all. No wonder poor end up poor, children of the middle end up in the middle, and children of the top, ha ha, find themselves at that point. And so finally, to the most familiar of the graphs. How much do the different parts of our society get when it comes to wealth and income? And I'm just recapping. These are statistics that hopefully you will have heard before. But if not, let me be the first. The bottom fifth of our population in America, this is based on statistics for the year 2010, the most recent that Demos had available. The bottom fifth, 20% of our people, together, what share of the income do they get in this country? 6%. 20% of the people at the bottom have to share 6% of the income. They don't get much. The second fifth, they get 10% of the income. 20%, not the poorest 20%, the next poorest, they get 10% of the income. Well, let's put the first three groups of 20% together. That gives us 60% of the people. That's the majority of Americans. 60% of the people, the 60% at the bottom, that's the majority of Americans, together, ready? Together get something on the order of 25% of the income. 60% of the people get 25% of the income. And now I'm going to go to the top fifth. The richest 20% of Americans together get 48% of the income. Roughly this way then. The top fifth of Americans, the richest 20%, get roughly half the income. And the other 80% of Americans fight over the other half. No wonder this is a society in which the poor get poorer and stay poor, the middle hope they can survive in the middle, and only the rich are in a position to reproduce, let alone expand that situation. But the distribution of income is nothing compared to the distribution of wealth in the United States. Income is how much you're getting flowing into you weekly, monthly. Wealth is how much you own. Let's take a look there. The bottom 75% of America, 75, three-quarters of Americans together own, you ready, 10% of the wealth of the United States. 75% of us together own 10%. The top 10% of Americans, the top 10% together, own 75% of the wealth. This is a society whose fundamental inequality, which has gotten worse for the last 40 years, now makes it a joke and a mockery when people have something to say and try to get us to believe it, that we live in a society of mobility and a society of opportunity. The statistics tell a different story. Let me turn next to something I hear so often that I've had to make a decision to comment on it in your questions and public statements. Taxes, we are told, are job killers. Here's the idea. If you tax a business, you create a disincentive for that company to invest and to grow and to hire people, you see, because they're not going to make as much profits as they used to, and so they're not going to hire people. So if you impose a tax on business, you're killing jobs. This is, if you pardon me from being blunt, stupid. It isn't a complex idea. It isn't a particular idea. It's a stupid idea. And it's stupid because it makes a fundamental mistake. If you want to assess the impact of a tax on jobs, you have to do two things. You can't look only at what the tax does. You must also look at what is done with the tax money raised by such a tax. In other words, when you tax a business, let's give them the argument. If you tax a business, or that group of businesses may decide to hire fewer people. But in order to assess the impact on jobs, you can't stop there. You have to ask, what is the government that levies that tax, what is it going to do with that money? Suppose the government decides to rebuild our cities. It's going to take the tax money and hire people to do that. Or it takes the money and expands our school system. It's going to hire teachers to do that. In order to show the impact of a tax on jobs, you have to look at what the impact of the tax is, and you have to look at what the impact of the money, the tax money spent by the government is. Looking at only one side is stupid. It's an ignorant person's reaction. And why would that be out there? Because the people pushing it have an idea they want to hawk, like shoddy goods. They want you only to see one side of the story, which is the side they want because they don't want to pay taxes. They don't want you to see the other side, which is what is done with that tax money and how many jobs are created that way and what kind of jobs are they. Once you look at that, you'll stop paying any attention to people hustling you by referring to taxes as job killers. The last update for today that I have time for has to do with a piece of information that came out in the last couple of weeks about that election earlier this year that I reported on, in which the United Auto Workers sought to organize a union at a Volkswagen, a VW factory in Tennessee. Documents were recently released, initially by station WTVF in Nashville, Tennessee, and then that was on March 31st. And then there was a follow-up story in the New York Times by Stephen Greenhouse on April 5th of this year. And here's what the stories revealed. The governor of Tennessee, a Mr. Bill Haslam, proposed $300 million in incentives to VW to expand its production at its facilities in Tennessee. That by itself is noteworthy. Politicians are doing that for corporations all the time. But what was remarkable in the documents revealed by the television station and then covered by the New York Times was the fact that what the governor proposed had a contingency clause. It was conditional. He wouldn't give it to them, the $300 million in incentives, that's the polite term they use, unless, and I'm going to quote now, the unionization efforts have to be concluded to the satisfaction of the state. Let's be clear here. Public money was going to be given to a private corporation conditional on the outcome of a union election. In other words, the government money was to be an encouragement to the corporation to make sure that the outcome of the election was what the state wanted. Governor Haslam made it clear what he wanted. He wanted the union effort to be defeated, which, by the way, in a narrow election, it was. Public money used to manipulate a union election. That is a new exposure in this country, a sense of what the government can be brought to do when you might have thought the government represents everybody. You might have thought that the government should be neutral in struggles between companies and unions. And if you thought that, you don't know about the activities of the state of Tennessee. And believe me, it's not alone. Last week on our program, we devoted ourselves, because it's tax season, to the federal government. How the federal government in Washington raises money. What kind of taxes are big and what kind are small. And which have grown. And you may remember that we showed you how the corporations have basically gotten most of the taxes they had to pay off of their backs. Whereas corporations paid Washington 40% of its income back in the 1950s, today they provide only 10% of the federal government's income. And who makes up the slack? Individuals, you and me. The corporate income tax has been cut, and the burden of taxation on individuals has been increased. And I promised you in that program last week that we would continue to talk about taxes, but that this week we would shift our focus, and I'm going to do that now. We're going to talk about taxes not levied by the federal government, but taxes levied by state and local governments. We have a system in the United States, a little bit different from many other countries, in which we have three levels of government all taking taxes from us. The federal government in Washington, the government in each of our 50 states, and then the government in whatever locality, town, city, village we live in. We pay different taxes to different levels of government. And here's why it's important to talk about state and local taxes. Because roughly half of all the taxes we pay, a little bit more than half, go to the federal government, and a little bit less than half go to states and localities. Localities, by the way, we use the term municipality in the United States. So state and municipal taxes are almost as big as federal taxes, and therefore they deserve our attention as much as federal taxes do. So let's first review the difference so we're all on the same page. The federal government relies overwhelmingly on the income tax. We pay a personal income tax, and then we pay a payroll tax, which is a tax on our payroll, which of course is an income tax too, because the payroll is the income we get from working. So the overwhelming bulk, 80% or more, of the federal government's income is from the income tax. That is not the case in the states, and it is not the case in cities and towns. In fact, the vast majority of cities and towns in the United States have no income tax at all. There are a few cities, New York City is the most famous, that do levy an income tax on their residents. But the vast majority of cities, towns, and villages have no income tax. Many states in the United States have no income tax, and even those states that do don't raise most of their money from the income tax. So let's look at what the states use, what they tax, and what the cities and towns do. States use what we call consumption taxes, sales tax. They tax you when you spend your money, whereas the federal government taxes you when you earn it before you have it to spend. So the federal government takes money out of your income when you earn it. The state government mostly takes money from you when you spend your money, when you buy clothing, when you buy furniture, when you buy electric equipment, and so on. So we call those consumption taxes or sales taxes. That's what states mostly rely on. And let's talk a little bit about this reliance of the state on sales or consumption taxes. The interesting thing about those is that they're not progressive. That is, they don't take more from those who have more, the way the income tax is set up. The income tax says you pay a higher percent the wealthier you are, the bigger your income. The consumption or sales tax doesn't work that way. Whether a Rockefeller family member buys a shirt in a store or you buy a shirt in a store, the sales tax is the same. It makes no effort to distinguish your ability to pay. It doesn't tax you more because you have more. Everybody pays the same. And what that means is that state taxes are not only not progressive, they are what we call regressive. Because for poor people, paying the sales tax on what you buy takes a bigger chunk of their income than paying the same sales tax takes out of the income of a richer person. In other words, instead of richer people paying a higher percentage of their income, it's actually the opposite. A regressive tax system, like we have in the States, because everybody pays the same when they buy an object, regardless of their income, regardless of their capacity to pay. The state taxes in America are overwhelmingly regressive. And when we get to the city or town, it's even worse, because there, the major tax isn't an income tax, and it isn't a consumption tax. Yes, there are a few cities and towns that have a sales tax like the states, but most don't. What is it that most cities and towns in America rely on? They tax property, something the federal government doesn't do. Federal government taxes income, not property. States don't do it either. They don't tax property. They tax when you spend money, their consumption tax. Only the local town, the local city, taxes property. It taxes land, one kind of property, business inventories, another kind of property, houses, another kind of property, automobiles often, another kind of property. They tax property at its value. And guess what? With very, very few exceptions, they tax every property at the same rate. So whether you're a person who has millions of dollars worth of land or you're a person who has $10,000 worth of land, the percentage you pay is the same. So if you're an owner of a lot of land, you earn a lot of income, the property tax is a lower percentage of your income than if you were a poorer person. So you understand, property taxes are regressive. They take less of the income of the rich than they do of the middle and the poor. Well, now let's put it all together. The federal government relies on a progressive income tax, a tax system that takes more the more you have. Richer people pay higher rates. That's for half of the taxes we pay. But state and local governments don't have progressive tax structures. They have regressive tax structures. They take higher percentages of the income of middle and poor people than they do of the rich. They do the opposite of what the federal government does. End result is the following. If you put together states and cities, and by the way, this is done by a group called the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, ITEP. And if you go to their website, ITEP.org, all of the statistics I'm giving to you now are presented in greater detail. And please make use of it. And I appreciate being able to make use of their data. If you combine all state and local property taxes, property taxes, sales tax, everything that states and localities do, here's how it works out. What is the portion of the income of the bottom 20% that they have to use to pay taxes to the cities and states in which they live? The bottom 20% pay 11.1% of their low income to states and cities. Okay, let's ask the middle 20% of America. What is the rate they pay out of their income, the middle income, to cover the taxes owed to the state and the city in which they live? 9.4%. Okay, look what we've done. The poorest pay 11.1% of their income on the taxes to the cities and states where they live. The middle pays lower, 9.4%. Now, the top 1%, the richest, what portion of their income do they have to pay to cities and states in which they live? 5.6%. So let's be real clear. For the top 1% of Americans, the percentage of their income they have to give to the cities and states in which they live as taxes is half, 5.6%, of what we require the poorest 20%. They have to give states and cities 11.1% of their incomes. The regressivity of the state and local government tax structures in America offsets, nullifies, cancels the progressivity of the federal income tax. So that when you put the total tax system together, it does not require of the rich a higher share of their income than it requires of the poor. It does do that for the federal income tax, but that is offset by having the reverse be the case for the states and the cities. After we take our short break in the middle of the program now, as we always do, we're going to come back and talk some more about taxes and who they impact and how. Stay with us. Come back shortly. We will continue.
These arms of mine, they are lonely, lonely and feeling blue. These arms of mine, they are yearning, yearning from wanting you, and if you would let them hold you, oh, how grateful I will be. These arms of mine, they are burning.
Welcome back. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update. I want to remind you that we're about to resume our conversation about taxes and tax structures, a topic that is perennially interesting, but particularly in April of each year as our federal income taxes come due. I want to remind you as well to take advantage of the two websites we maintain, rdwolff.com. And democracyatwork.info. They are both free. They are available to you 24/7. They contain a wealth of material updated continually, and they allow you to communicate with us your thoughts, questions, commentaries, and criticisms, and also to sign up for our newsletter, and finally, to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. Just click on the icon at either website to do that. Okay, we were talking before the break about state and local taxes in the United States, and I have a few more things to say. Thanks to ITEP.org, the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, I want to list to you now what they call the Terrible 10 States. The states where the bottom 20% of their people pay up to six times as much of their income in taxes as their wealthy counterparts. Wow. And you may be surprised by this list of 10. The most regressive state in the union, the state which most unfairly, because that's the simple, honest way to describe this, unfairly has a tax system at the state level that hurts the people at the bottom the most and panders to the rich the most, is the state of Washington, which in other ways is actually quite progressive. But here are the other nine in the top terrible 10. Those who burden their poor the most: Florida, South Dakota, Illinois, Texas, Tennessee, Arizona, Pennsylvania, Indiana, and Alabama. 10 states where the bottom 20% pay up to six times more as a percentage of their income for the state's tax take than the richest among the state's residents. It's really extraordinary. In fact, our whole tax system is extraordinary. And if you felt a resentment and an anger when you have to pay taxes, you're mostly justified. To get angry at the level of taxes is a mistake, because what you're missing is the fact that it isn't the level that's the problem, it's who's required to pay and who is exempted, who gets away with paying very little. It is absurd for the federal government to take more from the wealthy on the principle that those who have more should contribute more, and then have 50 states who don't do that, and thousands of communities, towns and cities that don't do it. If it's logical at the federal level, why is it illogical at the state or local levels? Moreover, if the states and the localities benefit the rich at the expense of the poor in the tax system, which they do, then obviously that nullifies whatever progressivity the federal tax structure has. Here's a final thought. It's about a scandal in our tax system that rarely gets discussed, and so it's precisely the sort of thing I want to talk to you about. This has to do with property. And there's more confusion about this than about almost any topic I ever discuss with people. Property. Property can be taxed in our country, but only in a very peculiar way and by very particular authorities. The federal and state governments do not tax property. Let me be real clear with you that you understand this. No federal authority measures how much property you have and then tells you you have to pay a tax for this amount of property that you own. The federal government doesn't tax the value of your property. Similarly, the states do not tax the value of your property. There are a few tiny exceptions, but the overwhelming reality is states do not measure and tax your property. The state and the federal government will tax income you earn from your property. Suppose you have a house and you rent it to people and they pay you a rental every month. You have to declare that on your income income forms, and you have to pay tax not on the value of the house, but on the income, the rental income you get. But I'm talking not about taxing the income from property, the rental on a house, the dividends on a share of stock, the interest on a loan. No. I'm talking about taxing the value of the property. The only level of government in the United States that does that significantly are local governments, cities, towns, villages. They rely on a property tax. They have an officer in every city and town called the tax assessor. And the job of the tax assessor's office in your town is to keep track of the value of houses, factories, stores, land, automobiles, and so on, so that the town can levy a tax on the value of that property. Okay? So the federal government doesn't tax property. The state governments do not tax property. The city and town taxes your property, measures its value, and says you have to give us 1% or 2% or whatever it is on the value of your property each year. But here comes the scandal now. The tax on property does not tax all property. Doesn't even come close. Remember what I listed to you a few minutes ago. The cities and towns tax the property in the form of land, property in the form of houses, property in the form of cars, property in the form of stores and factories. But here's a list of the property it does not tax. Property in the form of stocks, shares of stocks. Property in the form of bonds, loans you've made to corporations, you've gotten a bond. Cash that you own. That is not taxed. Property in stocks and bonds and cash is not taxed by cities and towns, which means that the property in stocks and bonds in this country, owned by whom? Well, we know that the top few percent of our people own 3/4 of all stocks and bonds. So we're talking only about the richest people. Here comes the scandal. Nobody taxes their property, not the federal, not the state, not the local. This kind of property, stocks and bonds, is called intangible property because you can't touch it in the normal sense of touching a piece of land or touching a building. It's just a piece of paper. But of course, if you have $100,000 worth of house, you pay a tax in the town where that house is located. If you sell the house and you hold $100,000 and you invest in $100,000 worth of stock, you owe your town nothing because it doesn't tax stocks. By choosing to tax property that most people have, cars, homes, and so on, and not taxing intangible property, which really only the richest of us have in any significant amount, you have set up a property tax system that is grotesquely unfair. There is no reason not to tax intangible property. There is no justification for exempting a kind of property that is concentrated among the richest people in our society, who therefore have to pay no tax at all on the form of wealth that they hold most of their wealth in, namely stocks and bonds. Really rich people, they have much more in their portfolio of stocks and bonds than they have in a home or a car. It's middle-income people who have a home or a car, and it's poor people who have one or the other or neither. They're not advantaged by having no intangible property tax. It's only the richest. It is an outrage to anyone with a sense of fairness that we would tax the kinds of property that average Americans have and exempt the kind of property that the richest have. Exempting intangible property from the property tax upon which cities and towns rely is an extraordinary injustice of the American tax system. And any new political movement that develops in the United States ought to, as a major priority, address a rectification. And to conclude, let me give you an idea. There is something on the order of 15 to 20, conservatively estimated, trillions of dollars out there in the value of stocks and bonds held by Americans in the 50 states. A very low rate of tax, 0.5%, 0.25%, levied on that property would bring states or the federal government, or both of them, and that applies to local governments as well, would give them a flood of money with which to avoid borrowing and deficits, with which to pay workers and provide public services, with which to lower taxes on other parts of the population. And who would it hit? The very richest amongst us. It would be a fair way to say to them, you've become very rich for the last 2 centuries of having your stocks and bonds exempt from taxation. It's the least you can do to begin now to take all that accumulated wealth, pay a tiny percent, and transform the economics of the cities, the states, and the federal government. A tax on intangible property, long overdue, among the many changes that an unjust tax system deserves and literally appeals for. In the remaining time for our longer discussions, I wanted to bring to your attention the work of a very interesting research think tank located in London, England. It's called the High Pay Center, with the word center spelled in the British way, C-E-N-T-R-E, rather than the E-R that we do here in the United States, the High Pay Center. And what they do is very interesting. They study high pay. They study the high incomes, particularly of leading executives across the world, not only in their own country, but around the world. And they've come up with some very interesting statistics, and I want to bring them to your attention. I learned from this British source a fact about American history that I want to share with you. Back in the Gilded Age, that period of time towards the end of the 19th century in American history, where the leading banker of his time, who became a famous personality because of his fabulous wealth, John Pierpont Morgan, made the following comment. He believed that the ratio of 20 to 1 between the head of a company and its average worker was reasonable. In other words, he said, it's reasonable if the head of the company gets 20 times as much money as the average worker. How interesting that this mogul, this titan, this captain of American finance thought it was reasonable to have 20 to 1. Why is that remarkable? Well, it's remarkable because many years later, the 1970s, one of the most famous management theorists in America, Peter Drucker, said the same thing. He agreed with John Pierpont Morgan. He thought a ratio of 20 to 1 is appropriate. Keep that in mind when I tell you that in 2012, the compensation received by chief executives of companies in the Standard & Poor 500, that's an index of 500 major corporations in America, was not 20 to 1. What was it? 354 to 1. The millionaires and billionaires of an earlier age were the richest people around, but they didn't imagine to justify or to endorse anything remotely like what has become the reality. Second interesting fact. Last year in Switzerland, a referendum was held. The people of Switzerland were asked to vote on whether there should be a restriction on corporate salaries and pay packages for their executives so that, ready, no executive could get more than 12 times what an average worker got. The people of Switzerland voted on that last year. They defeated, because the companies made an argument I'm going to get to in a minute, and the politicians often supported these corporations. Surprise, surprise. This proposition lost, but 35% of the voters in Switzerland voted for it. That is, over one-third of the people of Switzerland agreed with John Pierpont Morgan or Peter F. Drucker, the management theorist, that what we have today is way out of line and ought to be brought down to a 12 or 15 to 1 ratio. Well, what was the argument used by Swiss businesses and Swiss politicians to frighten the Swiss people into voting against something which all the polls showed a clear majority agreed with? How did they get down to having only 35% of the people vote for what they believed? The answer is fear. The argument was made, if we limit the amount of money an executive can get, well, by gosh, we're going to lose those executives. And we're not going to be able to get them. And we're going to have to get executives from someplace else that will accept less money. Well, what the high pay center then did was say, well, is that a real problem? Do corporations, when they are limited, do they ever go and get foreign people? Is it true that if a foreign company head earns less money than the one in your own country, you won't hire people in your own country? You'll go get the cheaper ones? And the answer is overwhelmingly not at all. Most American companies have American executives at the top. Most British companies have British executives, French companies have French executives. It turns out that this argument that you have to pay these a lot because otherwise they will go to some other country doesn't work that way. You disappoint a Swiss banker, he's not going to get a job in England. He's not going to get a job in France or America. Doesn't work that way. That's just hogwash designed to frighten people. The truth of it is that corporations around the advanced world in their countries favor overwhelmingly, less than 1% of executives in top companies come from another country. Okay, in the time that remains, and there isn't much of it for us, I want to turn to some of your questions and deal with them. Often I am asked the following question. When governments privatize, that is, when governments sell off the kinds of enterprises that used to be part of the government, for example, providing energy in many countries, the gas, the electric, and so on are provided by the government. In many countries, water is provided as a public service. When these have been privatized, when the government, to raise money, sells these to private companies, the argument that politicians make, since they don't want to admit that they are unable to run their government without selling off the property of the government, they make claims to the effect, oh, it'll be better for everybody because the private companies are very efficient and so they can provide this service at a smaller amount. What caught my eye in this regard was more work by this high-pay center in which they looked at the situation in Britain, and they looked at energy prices and they looked at water prices since privatization. And here's what they found. Over the last 10 years, the privatization of energy in England, the cost rose 140%, while income rose 20%. In other words, people in England were really socked by the privatization of energy. Water, the same thing. Since 1994 and 95, water bills have increased by 74%. Leakage, that is, breakages that had to be fixed, rose by 30%. It just reminds us not to be naive. Governments sell property because it's a way to avoid raising taxes on their people, and they want to get away with it, and so they do that. The claim that this is going to help the public by efficiency is more than offset by the profit-driven objectives of private owners of these services, who will do what they can to raise the prices, to save on the costs, and they end up costing us a lot. You know, after a while, when private provision of services breaks down, when the prices are too high and the quality of the service is too low, you know what they do? They have the government come in and take it over. When Amtrak, a private railroads in this country, couldn't function anymore the way everybody needed, the government was called in to take them over. Then a few decades later, the government sells it. It's back and forth. It has nothing to do with the quality of the service or the provision for the needs of the people. It has to do with who can make money by moving it one way or another, and that's a serious problem in our society. Last point for today that we will have time for. Over the last couple of weeks, a scandal has arisen because of a report released early in April about Medicare and about Medicare's payment of money to doctors around the United States. And it turns out, and the report makes this clear, that there are a whole group of doctors who bill Medicare for millions and millions of dollars a year. We're talking huge amounts of money. And that led Medicare to ask, thank God, the obvious question, why, since there's such a crisis about taxing people to raise the funds for Medicare, are we shelling out millions and millions of dollars to doctors? Well, the doctors are outraged. They got exposed for billing Medicare, and they want to pass the buck to the drug companies. Not fair. We have to pay so much for the medicines, and that's why we have to bill Medicare. It's not really going to us. We're paying the drug companies. Notice what's happening. What Medicare is doing is spending a fortune. Let me remind all of us listening to this program. The United States spends more money on medical care, doctors, hospitals, drugs, equipment for your diseases, and medical insurance. We spend more for those things than any other advanced country, much more. And the quality of our health is much poorer than most of those countries. We get mediocre health results, but we pay wildly more than everybody else. Why is that possible? Because we have a medical industrial complex in the United States. Those four industries work together: drugs, doctors, hospitals, medical equipment providers, and medical insurers. They take care of each other. And together, they cost us too much. And together, they cost Medicare too much. The bill may go to the doctor, but he's sharing it with all of the others in the medical industrial complex. We will not solve our health problems and improve our health. And we will not solve the hemorrhaging of outrageous amounts of money until we break the medical industrial complex. Stop having the world's costliest medical system that provides mediocre results. The latest scandal of Medicare is only the umpteenth chapter in the book of evidence that we have a broken, inefficient, wasteful medical system and ought long ago to have adopted what every other industrial country has: a national, medical, single-payer health insurance and health provision system. It is irrational and unfair not to have done that. Thank you again, as always. This is Economic Update. I'm Richard Wolff. Looking forward to seeing you and listening to you next week.
Change. They ain't gonna change. Got the blues. They ain't gonna change. They ain't gonna change. Change.